Hi, and welcome to another edition of Zoomed In. I'm your host, Brandon Chapman, and I'm joined by Hans Klar, an associate professor and assistant department chair of the Educational and Organizational Development Department at Clemson University, another great land-grant university, as well as Kristen Huggins, associate professor at WCU Vancouver. And I just reminded her that she is sitting on the prettiest campus in the WSU system. So both of you, thank you so much for joining me today. So today, what I wanted to talk about is this new book you have coming out, or that is out already, Developing Rural School Leaders, Building Capacity Through Transformative Leadership Coaching. And there's no mistaking that this is a rural setting, at least for the cover of the book. You see the school bus, right? And it is definitely not an urban street. It's a very, looks like they're out in the woods somewhere. Now, I don't know, maybe you can enlighten me on this. I don't know what constitutes rural versus urban in terms of the school setting. Maybe you know that, but you had some kind of interesting statistics that you had told me about before this Zoomed In, Kristen, that you had given me about the percentages of schools in the United States that are rural versus those that are urban. And you know, on one hand, I thought, yeah, this makes sense. On the other hand, it was kind of surprising what a huge percentage of schools are deemed rural. So real quick, maybe you could just tell me about that so we have the context of how important this book is.
So the data that you're referring to is that 53% of school districts in the United States are rural.
53%. Of school districts. So, you know, it seems like a lot of times I'm hearing different stories, and it deals with school in urban settings and things of that nature. And I don't know if that's just ease, if it's technology or what, but it seems like a lot of what I hear is dealing with schools in urban settings. So when I heard that 53%, that of course was surprising to me, but then it immediately became, hey, this is really a vital thing. So Hans, let me ask you first. So if you could set the 30,000 foot overview of this book, what the book is about, and then we'll dive into some of the reasons behind this book.
Yeah. Well, I think I just wanted to follow up on the note about the rural statistics, if that's okay. I think that it's important to note that the majority of school districts are rural, but only about 20% of students in the United States are in rural schools. So that really speaks to the smaller class sizes, or smaller schools at least, in rural areas. So there has been a stronger emphasis on rural education. A lot of that's warranted. It's where the majority of students are, and certainly we're all familiar with the trials and tribulations of some urban centers in terms of levels of poverty and large urban high schools. But rural education hasn't received as much attention until recently. The work that we've been doing, actually, we started in partnership with 12 predominantly rural and high poverty school districts in South Carolina. And we started that work in around 2012. But we'd had a long history with working with those school districts as a department of leadership preparation. And I think that's an important part of the story is, we couldn't just go in and knock on the door cold and offer to help, say the university's here and we're ready to help. We actually worked for many years developing relationships with these districts. So this book is really a culmination of the latest initiative with those districts. We called it the Leadership Learning Community. And through that, we spent about a year following up a pilot study and working with a steering committee made up of district leaders, both at the superintendent level, but also principals and other school leaders and university faculty. And we developed an initiative that allowed them to work across districts to find the capacity and to continue to foster the capacity of experienced leaders to serve as leadership coaches for less experienced leaders to support them in their development.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that is an additional interesting statistic that you brought up. This is just speculation on my part, but I can imagine because of where many universities are located, a lot of the research, it's just easier to do research in urban environments. But that really, I think, highlights some of the challenges for as many wonderful things as exist in rural education. You know, there are certain, I would imagine research is a little more limited. Professional development can be a little more difficult for folks, especially if they might feel isolated. You know, what are some of the leadership challenges that you encounter? Because this book talks about building capacity, right, through transformative leadership coaching. But what happens if a leader doesn't feel like there's any, you know, coach nearby, right? What are some of those challenges that you saw early on?
Yes, well, you alluded to one of the challenges, and that is finding professional development. And in rural schools, there also tend to be fewer administrators. For example, in smaller schools, they don't have as many assistant principals, or they can't afford other instructional staff to support. So principals end up wearing a lot of hats. And with other colleagues far away, and district offices perhaps also not staffed with other folks who could provide them with support, there isn't a lot of opportunity for professional development. So that was one interesting aspect of this initiative, that the 12 districts in this consortium work quite well together. And so when we were trying to pull this initiative together, we sent an invitation to all 12 superintendents to nominate leaders they would like to participate, and then other more experienced school or district leaders they would like to see participate as a coach for someone in another district.
Yeah, what was the response on that? I'm sure, you know, when you wear many hats, sometimes you see any opportunity as, yes, it's an opportunity, but it's also, oh no, that's a lot of time, right? I don't have the time to do the thing that I know that I need to do to get better or to improve. So did you find people were just clamoring to have that kind of support, or it was still maybe a little wary based on time commitment?
Yes and no. On one hand, there was a challenge that, you know, the university is inviting me to participate in a program, so this must be some kind of class, or there must be some kind of problem with the job I'm doing. And those were things that we worked really hard to make clear at the outset, and that was based on lessons learned from the pilot study we had done. But I'm sorry, I forgot the gist.
No, that's okay. That's okay, because, yes, inherent in the offers. Maybe right. Somebody thinking, right, there was something wrong in the first place.
So I remember your question now. Because of that, the fact that they are so busy, we were very careful in how we planned the opportunities to meet as well. So once a month, we all met together off campus. And at first, it was just the coaches. So we had a chance to introduce the coaches to new skills, but also to give them a chance to debrief and problem solve with their other coaching colleagues about the work they were doing with leaders. So they had a sense, a coaching community, a professional community for coaches. And then the leaders came in, and we had a light lunch, and they did some coaching together, and then we broke them up into groups again so that the leaders also had their own community. And then once a month, the coach and one of the university-based facilitators went to the leader's school for a job-embedded coaching session. And that provided them the opportunity to firstly get support without leaving their school, but also to really be able to relate the things they were learning to their immediate context. And of course, the coach and the facilitator became more familiar with their context and were able to support them to help them in that unique situation.
Now, Kristen, let me ask this, because you had given me a very well thought out and yet succinct description of some of the benefits of this kind of development. And one of the things that you had mentioned was most of the time professional learning for educational leaders happens in preparation, right? Not necessarily in practice. I know, you know, the College of Education at WSU, you know, principal preparation, you know, superintendent preparation, right? There's a lot of preparing these leaders, and not as much necessarily for in practice. Now, I get you know, I have four kids. They're all in the public school system right now, and they have a lot of these in-service days. And it wasn't until I got your description back that I started wondering, is this only for teachers? You know, is there service going on, development for the educational leaders, whether it's building administrator or somebody else that's in that capacity? I don't know in this case, but it seems to me like you hit on something, right? And that is, most focus is on teachers.
Yes, and a big win for our field this past decade was that in the rewrite of No Child Left Behind, ESSA set aside 3% for principal professional learning, which is kind of unprecedented for our field. And so states were allowed to determine based upon their plans whether they how they were going to use, but they were allowed to set aside 3% for professional learning. Now states did that differently, and they could think of leadership broadly, but the majority of states consider when they're thinking of professional learning initiatives, they're thinking of teachers.
Sure. So let me ask, how did you two connect on this amazing project? And at what point did you say, hey, let's write a book about this, because, you know, we have plenty of time. So let's figure out a way to put this in writing. How did that all come to be?
So we get asked this question quite a bit about how we collaborate. And so the reality is, we're both part of the University Council of Educational Administration, which is our national organization for research intensive universities that prepare leaders. And so in 2011, when I was presenting at UCEA a paper I had written, Hans was my discussant, and okay, we ended up having a conversation after that. And since then, we've both been a part of AERA's, the American Education Research Association's special interest group on leadership for school improvement. And we have our research interests aligned. We're very interested in the research that we do being meaningful to practice and really being helpful to districts that need help. And so where are those leaders that need the kind of resources we can provide? And where can we do that research that can also speak to the larger educational leadership audience?
Yeah, Hans, I'll let you weigh in on that from the moment you two met and started interacting, and how it came to be that, you know, that your research interests, obviously they aligned, but what I really want to know is who did the majority of the writing and who took credit for the group project?
Well, that's probably a recipe for ending a partnership. So yeah. But, no, it's really very rewarding and invigorating to have a thought partner and someone who you enjoy working with. Thankfully, we see it a lot in our field. People collaborate often on projects. I think it's a strength of our field, and certainly it's most of us enjoy working with other people as educators. And so it's definitely been a great feature of my career, is working with Kristen as well as a lot of colleagues here at Clemson and other places.
So when you went into this and you started doing some of the research, yeah, I mean, this has been ongoing, right? I mean, you've been doing this in your field for a long time. It's not like the research just started with the thought of writing a book, you know, but in that process, what stood out? At what point did you say, hey, this is really not what I expected? Like, this is a really juicy tidbit, you know, a good nugget of information that I feel like is now going to really add to the knowledge base in this field and could, you know, conceivably help leaps and bounds.
You know, as a facilitator, I went to a lot of schools with the coach, and we would show up at this school in a rural area, maybe a principal or assistant principal, instructional coach. And one of the things we learned straight away is before we could get to, you know, the next step in their action research process or talk about collecting data and what their next steps were, we had to help them deal with their pressing issues. We came to call it triage, and we just had to set aside a certain amount of time to deal with that. And in some ways, it's kind of funny, but also I can't tell you how many times I sat in front of people who would just burst into tears because they were so overwhelmed by the work and their dedication to it. So that's when we realized that, these folks needed this opportunity to work with other people in a structured program. And without it, I honestly believe they wouldn't have had it. And so we really were amazed that the potential of an opportunity like this. We're not suggesting that all research practice partnerships need to have leadership coaches and work with action research in this format. There's a lot of work still to be done in this area to figure out what's the difference that makes the difference here. But this is really needed. And so when we first approached the publishers about the book, they said, who's the audience? And we'd said, well, we'd like it to be pitched to practitioners and to scholars. And they said, yeah, that usually doesn't work. So we tried to strike a line down the middle where the book begins with a scholarly foundation of the literature about what it means to lead and to teach in rural schools and how to develop rural school leaders in our model. And then we actually provide three chapters of cases of our leaders and what they did and how they changed in this model. And then so we sort of bookended, if you like, with a final chapter talking about our lessons learned. So we hope that it will have impacts. We hope that district leaders, professional developers could pick this up and find some useful ideas in here. School leaders themselves maybe could recognize their context in here and see opportunities for support. And of course, we hope the scholarly community will find it useful and also, push our thinking in how we can make this project, this type of work better and more useful.
Yeah, and obviously these districts do want it to work. I mean, they were invested in this process. They work together with you to solve and study these solutions, as you had previously told me, which I think is really neat. One of the questions I always ask any of our research is the so what, right, at the end. So what? So you know what we know now, and obviously it's not the end of knowledge. We continue to research, but with this body of information, oftentimes things end up in a peer-reviewed journal article that six other people read in its entirety or what have you. I mean, this is a book that the folks are going to read, but then what do we do with that? How does it actually move to policy level or maybe help with some funding that's needed? Who needs to see this? Who needs to really be able to read through this and say, hey, I've got the means, the resources to make this happen. Who is that target audience, I guess?
So I think I'll answer that. We see, we are part of a networked improvement community across the nation called Rural Innovative School Leadership. And we all, through that network community, we've come to understand there are rural alliances all over the nation.
Okay.
And so how are they going to provide for their very context-specific leadership development? So one of the notions we put forth in the book is this notion of contextually relevant leadership. And that's really understanding all of the contextual variables that play out in any district and how that affects schools and school leaders. And so we see that these rural alliances are trying to look for how they develop leaders within those alliances. And so currently in the state of Washington, we have the Rural School Leaders Alliance, and their last initiative on leadership development was from new leaders out of New York City. And so we want to provide a model for people that is very specific to rural districts and schools and can develop rural school leaders with people using the resources and leveraging the resources that are close to them with the human capital in school districts, with seasoned leaders, as well as through research practice partnerships with universities.
Yeah, and I do wonder if folks working in education for the federal government at the state levels, if they we're able to see that educational leadership, right, really does affect student learning. And if 53% of schools are rural, meaning there's a good chunk of students in this country that are in that setting, well, I would imagine that some emphasis, some additional emphasis would be put on helping the educational leader. That would certainly, I think, improve and help progress that student learning. So kudos to both of you, I think, for taking this on. I'd ask about anything that had stood out. I'll ask that again, but of Kristen, in your time researching this, did you have an aha moment or anything that was not what you expected that you thought was kind of neat?
Yes. So Hans was one of the university facilitators, and I was one of the external reviewers to increase the trustworthiness of the research. And so one of the major findings was, for me, because I was specifically focused in on the leadership coaches, was the amount of learning that these seasoned leaders who had already enacted, been school principals, most of them. And so just the level of learning they needed around how to coach. And so most of them took a very directive stance with their leaders early on. And we had to backtrack and kind of redo the professional learning sessions to meet their learning needs. And so I think one of the ahas for us is just meeting every leader wherever they are developmentally. And it has no real connection per se to what professional roles they have inhabited. So they could have been a principal, but we can't make some assumptions about what kind of learning they have as a principal. So where are they in their leadership learning? And then their ability, so not only their own leadership learning, but their ability to help develop other leaders. So that was a huge learning for us too, was not only where the coaches were in their own understanding as leaders and their own learning, but also in their ability and desire to build the capacity of other leaders.
Yeah, that's really neat. And I can't imagine we can have transformative leadership coaching if there is a one size fits all approach. So I appreciate you mentioning that. Any last words? And Cons, every time I look at you and I see your virtual background, I keep thinking, man, is it really fall there in Clemson, just outside of Greenville? I mean, it's a gorgeous place, but I can't imagine it's fall. Any last words from both of you? Anything that you want to say? You've got the open mic, against my better judgment.
I guess a couple of our takeaways throughout the whole process was how much the turnover of school leaders impacted their learning and their ability to participate in this program. In some cases, they were moved jobs, roles within their schools. In some cases, they were moved entirely out of districts. In some cases, health issues in either their own or their family members impacted their ability to contribute. So it was really disruptive when these things happened, and it just really speaks to the need to develop stability in the leadership core of these schools, which is again one of the factors in the research that we see, a high turnover rate. On a more positive note, we saw the benefit, perhaps the imperative need for relationships, that when you're trying to develop a coaching relationship with a leader, you really need to get to know them as people and as individuals, of course, and their strengths and weaknesses and what they're trying to accomplish. And as facilitators, we needed to earn the trust of all the participants, that especially being from the outside, being the researchers, being from the university, we had to work hard to develop their trust, for them to know that we were there to honestly and truly assist them in the work that they were doing, and to ensure that it was the work that they needed to do, not the work that we needed them to do for us. And so I think as a result of our efforts to develop relationships with people, it was much more successful than it might otherwise have been. So I think that's another really significant lesson for anyone interested in developing research practice partnerships with districts.
Cool. Kristen, anything to add?
I would just add, I actually would in some ways echo what he says. I think one of the things we came to understand was just the level of change that we needed to do in order to respond. And so we had to question our own learning and question our own assumptions and question what people really needed. And so, and then meeting that need instead of meeting our need first. So I just think that's one of the things that research practice partnerships are becoming prevalent across the nation, but I think there's a call for researchers to re-examine who they are and what they're willing to change to do those partnerships.
Very good. Well, the book's called Developing Rural School Leaders. Both of you, I thank you so much. Hans Klar from Clemson, from Death Valley, as they say down there in Clemson, and Kristen Huggins from WCU Vancouver. Really do appreciate you both for joining me. And I hope this book has a positive, large impact that can be felt for years to come. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A pleasure.